I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, lockdowns, masks, and gloves, maybe just for the time being, but it's possible the pandemic will cause some permanent changes in the way we live. We'll spend this hour with The Atlantic's Derek Thompson, who says COVID-19 is likely to reset our urban equilibrium, driving many mom-and-pop businesses to extinction as it strengthens national chains and making densely populated cities less desirable, but also cheaper places to live. We'll talk about how closing our doors to almost all immigrants will change entrepreneurship patterns and learn how restaurants that survive will have to change their menus. Our conversation starts after a short break. Soon to know precisely how long COVID-19 will stalk a defenseless human population, but there's no question that we'll feel its effects long after we stop fearing we might catch it from a dirty doorknob or a lung full of contaminated air. American cities, in particular, may be permanently altered by the pandemic. At the end of all this, they could experience a kind of renaissance, but only after a long and very difficult period of upheaval. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Derek Thompson writes about economics, technology, and the media for The Atlantic. Recently, he's been reporting on the way COVID-19 is shifting the landscape for businesses. Many small firms are struggling to stay afloat, even as big chains enjoy record sales. This will have real implications on the way densely populated areas work, possibly making cities less vibrant and desirable for some time, also less expensive for the first time in decades. Thompson's article, "The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever," is available online. Derek, welcome back to Think.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So you live in Washington, D.C., which has our attention at the moment, not least because of White House officials recently diagnosed or currently quarantining. What is it like to walk down your street these days?
Oh, it's an extremely desolate experience. I walk down these parts of Washington, D.C., like Georgetown and M Street and K Street, that are typically bustling and so full of people that you have to sort of walk sideways, where you're constantly doing this kind of hopscotch shuffle to get down the street. And now you can basically walk in the road. The only thing, I joke to friends that the only thing that is reminiscent of it is these sort of post-apocalyptic movies where, you know, people can easily sort of, you know, carry a satchel over their back down the middle of the thoroughfare and not risk walking into any cars. You know, sometimes on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, that's basically what it is. And that's really how I began this investigation, is walking down M Street from where I live, which is right by Georgetown, which is in the west of the city proper, and walking east and looking to my left and right and just seeing this long line of darkened windows and wondering to myself, which of these companies are, and these businesses, these stores and restaurants, who's going to come back when this is all over, and who's not going to make it, and how is that gap between those who make it and those who don't, how is that going to reshape not only the character and the face of this street that I was walking down, M Street, but city streets all across the country?
I've never tried to run a business, so I honestly didn't realize how little cash on hand small companies typically keep. Most of them that have been closed for a month or more are probably already out of money.
I think that's a pretty fair estimate. I think that for a lot of these shops and these restaurants and these small stores, they keep enough cash on hand to last them a few weeks, maybe a few months. But, you know, I've been in lockdown essentially since the middle of March. That's 2 months right there. So I am beginning to be very concerned about the ability of these small businesses to survive this crisis, which is, I think it's important to say, a crisis that they should not have been expected to plan for. This is an act of God. This came from outer space. It's akin to an asteroid slamming into the planet. It's a once in a century plague. And so I think that you have some people who say, oh, well, you know, these businesses, the ones that didn't save enough or the ones that weren't responsible with their money, they deserve to be felled. And if we cull them from the business landscape, we'll be left with a more resilient and sturdy landscape. I don't see that at all. I don't think these businesses should be punished. I welcome the government's efforts to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to save just about every small business out there that wants to be saved, that wants to take on this money. And I hope, frankly, that we do more even than we've done.
So, yeah, what about that? There was this, you know, we've had a couple of stimulus packages. Why has it been so hard for a lot of mom and pop businesses to get a share of that federal loan money, at least meant to help them keep paying employees?
So there's a couple reasons why I think the payroll protection program, PPP, has been a better help to larger companies than smaller companies. I'll give at least two big reasons. One, you could argue that these larger companies tended to have better relationships with their local banks, with their commercial banks, which means that when they realized that there was a crisis, they could go to those banks and say, we need to take out a big loan. And those banks knew that that loan was going to be backed up by the federal government. The big banks, the big companies had those relationships, and the smaller companies didn't. I also think that there's something to the fact that, you know, these smaller companies don't necessarily have the personnel to deal with these kind of crises. They don't necessarily have a huge legal department, a huge HR department. If it's a mom and pop store, the mom and or pop is running the store and is the CEO and is the chief counsel and is the head of HR. They're in charge of everything. And so they don't necessarily have the labor structure to handle something as complicated as keeping a place running, then shutting it down, then applying for a loan, then following what the government's saying about PPP. That's very, very complicated. And I know even experts, journalists and small businesses that are following this like a hawk, that were very, very confused about exactly how this program would work. You really needed a legal expert to be following along. And it tended to be, say, the chain restaurants who had those legal experts rather than the restaurants, the independent shops that really were just a handful of people.
How did big chain restaurants end up qualifying for this money? I recognize that maybe at one particular store location, they might have a small number of employees, but clearly these are big businesses.
Yeah, they are big businesses. The PPP law wanted specifically to save restaurants, which I think is an important thing. Restaurants are a really critical part of our culture. And as a result, they amended the PPP to essentially say that if you had a low number of people working at a certain franchise location, that you would qualify, and an expanded qualification for restaurants themselves. So essentially, larger restaurants, even publicly traded restaurants, had an ability to sign up for PPP money in a way that similarly large companies in other industries might not have had the same opportunity. And as a result, what happened rather famously, or I should say infamously, is that you had companies like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and Potbelly's and other large companies that have many, many locations across the country, essentially qualifying for millions of dollars, many millions of dollars of aid that didn't go to small businesses. Now, I do want to say that I think, you know, for a week or so, this created a moral panic, a sort of an outburst of outrage at these larger companies for taking on the money. I don't think that those companies necessarily deserved the outrage that they got. I think that the problem was that there just wasn't enough money allocated to help every small business and every medium-sized business, and even some large businesses that should have qualified for this kind of bailout. This wasn't enough money available. So I would liken the government's efforts to help small businesses is like, imagine a bread line. Imagine a city experiencing a depression that sets up a bread line, and they make a decision to only store enough bread to feed one third of the city. Well, what's going to happen? People are going to line up. You're going to have some higher income people at the front of the line. And when it's all said and done and the money is run out, you're going to have lots of people pouring to the rich people saying, hey, they got bread, and all these poorer people did not get the bread. Is that the fault of, you know, the higher income individuals who just wanted some bread? Or is it the fault of the state for setting up a bread line with only one third of the bread necessary? I do think that this is a federal problem, and it is being fixed. And I hope it continues to be fixed by the most obvious federal solution there is, which is just throw more money at this problem, allocate more resources to save more small businesses so that we don't have this mass of bankruptcies just swarming the economy as we're trying to recover from the plague.
So I get that if you work at Ruth's Chris and that's your job, it doesn't really matter to you if it's a big corporation or a small company. If you're shuttered and not taking in money, you're going to want the money. Ruth's Chris did give the money back, but was there any kind of means test set up for companies that sought that cash, or realistically, would that have delayed access to funds that some business really did need right away?
Yeah, there were preconditions about the size of the business. Amazon, Microsoft, they weren't available for PPP money. So qualifications were there to limit it to businesses that generally had fewer employees. At the same time, though, there is, I think, a national interest and a very reasonable interest to save restaurants. They're an extraordinarily important part of American culture. You could argue that restaurants have never been more important to American culture. For most of American history, we Americans spent more money on groceries than dining out. But in the last 5 years, for the first time in history, we spent more money dining out than buying groceries. That is, I think, a signal of the fact that restaurants are just a really critical part of urban infrastructure, a critical part of how Americans make decisions about where they're going to move. So I do think that the attention paid to restaurants and the qualifications extended to restaurants in the law were reasonable. What was not reasonable was the dollar amount. They put about $350 billion worth in there. It should have initially been closer to $700 billion or more. And my hope is that they continue to allocate more money to save more small businesses and more small restaurants.
Okay, so you and I are fortunate enough to still have our jobs and be earning a paycheck. I don't know about you. I've cut back drastically on my spending because there aren't that many places to go and spend money at the moment. Theoretically, lots of folks would be ready to buy things when the all clear sounds, but you have a sense that this current pullback, by a lot of people who are still employed may be a preview of what's to come.
Yeah, it is going to be a preview of what's to come. I first want to say that my fiance and I actually did this exact same exercise. We looked at our credit card bills recently and sort of graphed the difference between we're somewhat nerdy, I guess. I guess most couples don't necessarily graph their spending, but sort of went to Excel and graphed our spending going back 6 months, and we're spending way less money than we were a few months ago, precise for exactly the reason that you said, that we are cut off from the face-to-face economy that's a source of so much spending and so much joy in our lives. We love bars and we love restaurants and we love being able to go out and shop with our friends, and we just can't do that in Washington, D.C. right now. And so this is the story writ large across the country, and it's why so many restaurants and stores, everyone who would have received the dollars that we would have been spending, are suffering so much right now. And so when I sort of roll this picture out and think, okay, how are present circumstances going to change the American city that exists, say, a year from now? I see what I sort of three categories of change. I see accelerations, I see inventions, and I see interruptions. So one big acceleration is the acceleration of the big getting bigger. I think that for a variety of reasons, you're going to see large companies get bigger. Whether it's chain restaurants getting bigger, or Uber just announced that they're trying to buy Grubhub, which owns Seamless, sort of a food delivery company. I think you could see a lot of tech companies getting bigger as well. That's an acceleration. Then you have inventions, new behaviors that are taking off. I know my grandmother and a lot of other older Americans are just now discovering the joys of Instacart and grocery delivery. They're recognizing that, oh, they don't have to get in their car and drive to the grocer and spend all that time waiting in line. They can wait and order online. So I think that is a new behavior that's been invented for senior citizens in this crisis. And then you have interruptions. So I love restaurants deeply, as I think I've made abundantly clear already in the last 18 minutes. And I cannot wait to be able to sit down in a restaurant with friends and family again. I can't do that right now, but in 2 years, in 3 years, I have no doubt that I'll be able to eat in dozens of restaurants in Washington, D.C., and hopefully, much sooner than 2 and 3 years. So that I very much hope and also expect is an interruption. So throughout this piece that I wrote called The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever, I go through a bunch of different parts of the urban retail landscape and think, okay, what is being accelerated? What is being invented? And what is merely being interrupted?
My guest is Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. As he mentioned, that article is "The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever." This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with The Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, whose recent article, "The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever," is available now online. So, Derek, as you explain in this piece, the pandemic isn't necessarily creating all new behaviors, but it is accelerating pre-existing trends. You mentioned things like grocery and food delivery. Why had we built up so much brick and mortar retail space in the United States in recent years?
That is a great question. Honestly, it's sort of a million-dollar question. It's a question that where there's a lot of debate. Let's establish the facts first. The U.S. has so many stores. I mean, we have so many stores compared to similarly rich countries. We have 5 times as many stores per capita as the U.K. We have 10 times as many stores per person as Germany. I mean, people in the UK and Germany, as far as I know, have couches and are wearing shirts and, you know, have milk and rice in their kitchens, but they just don't need nearly the amount of retail, physical retail space in order to buy those goods. So why does the US have so much retail, or why is it, as some people say, overstored? The answer probably has to do with the extraordinary abundance of space that we have in this country, not only in Texas and in the South and Midwest, but just across the entire country. We have much more space than the UK and Germany in which to live. And that abundance of geography has been married to federal and state law that has often encouraged people to move out into the suburbs, whether it's the mortgage interest deduction, essentially encouraging people to buy bigger homes, or an extraordinary amount of infrastructure spending going to roads and highways to make it more efficient and easy for families to live in the suburbs and work in cities. And as a result, because we sort of have these policies and this geography that naturally spreads people out across the country, we also have this wild abundance of retail space. For the most part, you know, you could argue that, you know, there might be problems embedded in that spatial arrangement of the population, but it's not that much of a moral problem if people just enjoy having more space to shop in. Where it becomes a problem is when this extraordinary abundance of space runs into a pandemic, where a lot of that space has to be shut down, and where an enormous amount of spending veers from the offline brick and mortar world into the online world. So every year this century, e-commerce has grown as a share of total retail by about 1 percentage point a year. So it goes from 9 to 10% of total retail, and then 10 to 11, 11 to 12. At the beginning of this year, it stood at about 14 or 15% of total retail, all right? So about $1 in every $6 that Americans spent on retail, they were spending online. That number doubled in just the last 6 weeks. So talk about big accelerations, the first category of change that I talked about. This is a huge acceleration. We've essentially had 15 years of e-commerce growth happen in a month and a half. And as a result, I think a lot of people who pay a lot of attention to the present and future of retail are really concerned about this this overextension of physical retail space. What happens to all of these stores, all of these malls, and these strip malls when Americans are spending twice as much as they currently are online, where they don't need those stores to exist in the first place? I think it's a really interesting and provocative point that should sort of force us to think critically about how we want to use that space in the future.
And by the same token, we now, I think, forever will associate COVID-19 with the bankruptcies of companies like J.Crew and Neiman Marcus. It certainly didn't help, but they were struggling before.
They were struggling before. I think a lot of these companies, especially those that just sold clothes or that were department stores, essentially met their match with the internet. That it turned out that people were fine, especially younger people, were fine shopping for clothes online. And it also turned out that Amazon was a better department store than almost any physical department store that existed. So I think that you know, you already had these extraordinary threats to department stores and to J.Crew and to those kind of places before the pandemic struck. And the pandemic has been an accelerant for all of the forces of e-commerce.
Okay, lots of people are discovering, I should say lots of people with salaried jobs in the knowledge fields are discovering that they can do their work pretty well from home. Some people really like it. I'm wondering what you think will happen to commercial real estate at the end of all this when companies reassess whether they need to spend so much on a big set of downtown offices rather than keeping people at home.
Well, oh, this is a great, huge question. You know, there's a couple considerations with commercial real estate. One question has to do with ground floor retail. You know, what happens if you're a commercial realtor or you're a landlord and your ground floor restaurant is a French restaurant that tightly packs its chairs together in a dark, unventilated space with no outdoor seating? Well, in January 2020, I would have said that's a wonderful restaurant that I absolutely want to go to. But now, in May of 2020, that's a restaurant that I don't want to be anywhere close to for the next few months. And so I think that they're going to struggle with replacing sort of their ground floor retailers. But you're also right that, you know, commercial realtors also have offices. And I think that, you know, you saw today that Twitter announced that they're going to allow their entire workforce to work from home indefinitely. I think you're going to see not so much that this sort of work from home present that the white collar workforce is enduring at the moment is going to totally take over and we're living today through that which will be the future of work forever. I don't think that's it. I think it's more correct to say that the future of work will be hybrid. You'll work a little bit from home and you'll work a little bit from the office. And you might work a little bit more from coffee shops and third places like WeWorks and things like that. But you'll cobble together an office that exists across space and not exclusively within one office. And as a result, you know, companies won't need as much office space. And if every single company makes the decision that they need, you know, 10%, 15% less office space, you know, the ripple effects for commercial realtors could be huge because you could essentially see that, you know, prices could decline or the space requested could decline across the board by 10 or 15%.
So if urban commercial rents decline, what will happen to urban residential rents and mortgage rates? Or not mortgage rates, but housing prices.
So I think that what's going to happen for, you know, I actually just had a debate about this with a friend who he said that he thought that the suburbs were going to be the most hurt by this because they would see the closure of a lot of strip malls. Here's what I think is going to happen. And it begins with a very untechnical point, kind of an emotional point about cities. I've lived in cities all my life. I know that most Americans haven't necessarily lived in cities all their life. So I want to be respectful that there's a diversity of preferences here. But the reason that I love cities is because of their diversity and their density and their energy and the throng of people and the extraordinary heterogeneity of restaurants and cuisines that you can try in places like Washington, D.C. and New York. And I think a lot of that is going to be taxed or punished by the plague. The plague is a tax on crowds. And for that reason, it is in many ways a tax on what makes cities cities. As a result, I have to expect that the demand for city life in the next 6 months to a year is going to diminish, that people who live in cities that were thinking about moving to the suburbs are going to accelerate that decision. People who were thinking about moving to cities might delay that decision or move to the suburbs. And a lot of people who felt like they were being priced out of the city in the first place are going to say, well, I was already paying 30% extra to live somewhere that had the buzz of excitement and where I could, you know, meet singles in crowded bars. But now that it's illegal to gather in a crowded bar, I definitely am not going to pay 30% extra for the next few years. And so they're going to leave cities as well. So I do think that you're going to see a mini exodus from a lot of sort of dense downtown areas that we sort of consider the most classic cities in America. And then as a result, you're going to see more people move to the suburbs. And as people spill out of cities, cities will get cheaper. And this run up in prices that you've seen over the last few years, especially in coastal cities, but really in just about every city across the country, you know, certainly in Austin and Nashville, that you're going to see those prices start to come down. And in the next few years, it might be, you know, cheaper to move into a city. So there'll be sort of a what I call a forest fire effect, that the pandemic will will burn out a certain equilibrium that exists in the city today, that it will, you know, reduce a lot of city vibrancy to ash. But then in that ash, as the sunlight reaches the forest floor, a lot of new kinds of businesses and new kinds of people will be, ideas will be stimulated, because the people that move back into cities in a year or two will be a different kind of public. It'll be more middle class. It might be more diverse, and it might be more inventive.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Kirk is calling us from Glen Rose, Texas. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's very interesting. It seems to me this whole situation is creating a high demand for what I call self-reliance. You know, you mentioned curbside shopping. Where I live, you can't buy any home exercise equipment. It's all sold out. Can't even buy a hot tub. So it seems to me that people are right now demanding these things that help them be more self-reliant in whatever area of their life. If this demand stops and goes back to what used to be normal, then I guess it's a moot point. But if this remains a permanent demand, it seems like it's going to create a whole new industry industries that focus on helping people be self-reliant in many, many areas.
Thanks for your call, Kirk. What do you think about all that, Derek?
That's a really interesting point. You know, I made the observation to somebody else last week that in some ways this pandemic sort of thrusts us back into the 1890s. So why the 1890s? It's somewhat kind of a random decade to analogize this to. Well, the 1890s are before you have sort of the biggest urbanization wave in the U.S. You had lots of Americans living on small farms. So you didn't necessarily have restaurants and all of these sort of, you know, face-to-face stores that you have today. So people did a lot of stuff in home. They taught their kids at home. They worked at home, typically on farms. But they also had access to a virtual retailer. They had access to Sears and the Sears Bible of Goods. They could order all sorts of stuff essentially online, except there was no internet. There was just a post office. So they would send, they would, you know, fill out an order list and mail it and then get their goods mailed back to them. And so in many ways, I saw that the same way that in the 1890s, you had a homebound life with the addition of a virtual retailer. Today, we also have a homebound life with the addition of a slew of virtual retailers like Amazon and food delivery. So I guess the question is that kind of life truly self-reliant? In a way, I guess you could absolutely argue that it is. I'm certainly cooking for myself a lot more. I can't hire somebody to come, you know, clean my apartment the same way that I could 6 months ago. So I'm cleaning my apartment. You know, I'm cooking everything almost everything that I'm eating. That is increased self-reliance. But I also think that in ways that might sometimes be invisible, you know, I still rely on thousands, millions of people to live. I rely on supply chains. I rely on the people who help keep my apartment running and keep the water running. I rely on people who, you know, fix up the infrastructure in order to make, you know, Washington, D.C. navigable. And so I think that it's important to, you know, be clear about the fact that, yes, there is a little bit more self-reliance that is necessary in a pandemic. But at the same time, I don't want us to become too beguiled by this concept of rugged individualism, such that says, you know, we don't need anybody, we just need ourselves. I rely on so many people, and so I imagine does everyone listening.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, Derek, the president acted very quickly to limit immigration in the wake of COVID-19, including legal immigration in kind of unprecedented ways. What do immigrants typically do for cities where they settle?
Immigrants are absolutely critical to the energy of American cities today. Most of the largest American cities, certainly New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, would not be growing for the last decade if it were not for immigrants coming to those cities. As a result, when they do arrive, they tend to innovate at much higher rates than native-born Americans. And the way that they're entrepreneurs tends to be focused in restaurants and retail. So when you walk down the street of a major American city and you're looking at restaurants and you're looking at shops, you're often looking at the work of immigrants that have come into the country. So they're an absolutely critical part of the face of the American streetscape. And I am concerned that in addition to all the terrible things that this pandemic is doing, that if the president or other politicians clamp down on immigration in the long haul, it will exacerbate sort of the withering of American cities today.
You say we're likely to see the end of what you've called the golden age of restaurants. How did we get the sort of restaurant scene we did have until earlier this year?
Well, you know, I think that a couple things happened. So to make the story kind of a 100-year story to see sort of the full history of this, I actually start in the piece by looking at what happened after Prohibition. So exactly 100 years ago, in 1920, you had the Prohibition Amendment passed, and that obviously banned the production and sale of alcohol. And that actually really changed the face of American restaurants. American restaurants previously had sort of high-class American restaurants had relied on booze and alcohol in order to keep their profits. And when alcohol was effectively banned, a lot of restaurants went out of business. At the same time, in the 1920s, the number of restaurants in America tripled. And it tripled because of the invention of a new kind of restaurant, the lunch car diner. And diners sort of took over the American culinary landscape. Diners served, you know, burgers and hot dogs and milkshakes to sober parents and their kids. It had to be, you know, food that was kid friendly. And as a result, I think you could argue that the American palate was somewhat infantilized between the 1920s and 1950s, the heyday of the diner, because almost every meal was effectively fit for a kid. What happened in the last 30 years, however, is that I think you really saw this renaissance of fine dining. Every city in America that I could find when I reported this out a few years ago has claimed at some point in the last 5 years that they're going through some food renaissance, that it's a golden age of restaurants, that prepared food has never been better. And I worry that that moment, that brief golden age of the American restaurant is going to be shut briefly, if not more permanently, by the pandemic, because this makes, you know, fine dining impossible at the same density that it was previously. And it pushes a lot of food preparation to delivery, where not every meal tastes as good together. Sometimes you need comfort food to be delivered rather than, you know, prepared halibut. So I do think this will change restaurants quite a bit going forward.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking about his recent article, The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Derek Thompson, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic and recently published an article titled "The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever." Derek, in my travels around the United States, it's occurred to me that suburbs tend to have very similar retail outlets, right? You can find like that Bed Bath & Beyond and the Chili's and whatever in the strip mall outside Minneapolis, the same one that you can find outside Austin, Texas, or outside, you know, Nashville, Tennessee. Some people really like that. Some people don't. But it's different in cities often. Will we start to see cities boasting precisely the same kinds of stores, no matter whether you're in New York or Boston or Cleveland or San Francisco?
Yeah, I think this is a huge concern. I'm very fond of a quip from the playwright Tennessee Williams from the middle of the 20th century, where he said, there are only three cities in America, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland. Now, I think that's fairly mean to Cleveland, so I want to apologize to anyone listening who comes from Cleveland. But it goes to this idea that the American city has for a century been in this tug of war between sort of wealth and weirdness, that there's some cities that are delightfully weird, and the richer they get, the more homogenous they seem to get. And that already in New York, you're beginning to see that a lot of specialty stores and unique stores were closing down, while a lot of really, chains essentially were exploding in terms of their presence across the city. So I do think that one thing that could absolutely happen with this crisis is that you could see a lot of small business failure among shops and, you know, bodegas and restaurants for sure. And that the companies that move in to fill those empty spaces are going to be chains. And that means that, you know, if you're walking around New York and, you know, walking around Austin and Dallas and San Francisco and St. Louis, that everywhere you go begins to kind of feel like everywhere that you've been. And that's a sad prediction for the future of cities, that essentially everywhere essentially gets Clevelandized. At the same time, though, I want to hark back to the prediction that I make in this article, which is that we're looking at kind of a bifocal future. Sort of, there's two different predictions that I'm making. First, I think in the short term, you are going to see this sort of sweeping homogenization of the American city as a lot of really unique stores and unique shops and restaurants fail because of the plague. At the same time, I think that that sets us up for a second act of the American city, that as these small places fade and as some people move away, that rents will decline, commercial rents and residential rents, and you know, mortgage or housing prices will decline in a lot of cities. And as a result, that means it'll be easier for the middle class to move back in, and it'll be easier for middle class immigrants to move back in. And you could see a bit of a renaissance of the American city from a creativity standpoint. So that's certainly what I'm hoping for. Certainly not the first part of that prediction, but that we have that silver lining.
So people in Leadville, Colorado, like to boast that they were once bigger than Denver. People in Silver City, New Mexico, talk about once being bigger than Albuquerque. All around the country, there are these places that used to be boom towns and then faded for a variety of reasons. Could we see the sort of locus of our biggest cities shifting after this?
You could, I think. You know, every decade has its urban winners and losers. You know, just thinking back, I guess, to the last decade, to the late 2000s and 2010s, you saw the explosion of Austin, certainly. I remember looking at census figures every single year and seeing that Austin was the fastest growing large city in America for something like 7 consecutive years. You know, it wasn't necessarily exploding in the 1960s, 1970s. There were other cities that were growing that fast. I remember that I think in the 1950s, Youngstown, Ohio, was the richest or second richest city in the country. And now it has the unfortunate distinction of being the largest city that has lost population over the last 20 years. So, you know, you're actually right that American cities are kind of like an accordion, that the bellows go out and the bellows go in. People leave and they come back, and the winners and losers change decade after decade. But what makes American cities distinct and so beloved by people, I don't think that's going to change. And I do hope that in the medium and long term, we get back the elements of cities that we so love and need.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Garvin is on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Garvin.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Derek. My question is a little broader in nature. Derek, what do you think will happen to salaries in general for various professions? I know you wrote about retail, but nobody needs to drive to work anymore. Or, I'm sorry, fewer need to drive to work. You don't need such nice clothes to go to work because you can work from home. All those kinds of things. What do you think will happen in the long run over or with salary?
Thanks for calling.
All this?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, this salary is blessedly, I say this as someone who doesn't take a lot of care in my my sartorial life and my outfit. Salary, blessedly, is not necessarily overall correlated to how fancy you dress, but how productive you are and how much profit or how much revenue the company has in order to pay you. So to predict that salaries would become sort of permanently pinched across the economy would imply the economy itself would be permanently pinched. I'm not sure that I think that's going to happen. I do think that we're going to recover from this crisis the same way that we generally recovered from the Great Recession as well. But again, I do think that you could see a shift of composition, a shift within the economy. You know, already I think you can, you know, potentially see that there are certain activities that might sort of be less popular in the economy that's going to greet us on the other side of this. So, for example, you could see that you know, conference calls or that meetings might be more likely to happen over Zoom than forcing everyone to move to the same city to participate in the same room. If you think about what that could do to salary, well, on the one hand, you could say maybe they just pay everyone the same salary no matter where they live. You could also imagine that people could sort of arbitrage and say, well, look, we have a San Francisco salary that we pay, but we also have, you know, a salary that we pay if you're going to live in, you know, rural Washington. And you can take your pick. And so maybe people are going to make a choice to earn a little bit less, but live in cheaper areas. And as a result, taking less money because they're living in a cheaper area, they'll have more left over to spend and they'll have a more balanced life. You could certainly see something like that. But I don't think that, overall wage growth is going to be terribly affected by this crisis over a 10-year period. I do think that we're going to see a lot of pain in the next year, maybe even the next 2 years. But looking out, say 10 years from now, I don't think people are going to say, well, wage growth overall is still slow and disappointingly bad. And it's all because of that plague that started 10 years ago. I don't think that's going to happen.
We have an email here from Dana who wants to know how city governments might be affected by a reduction in the tax base that results from lost businesses.
It's a huge and awesome question. You're already beginning to see a lot of state legislatures and governors say, all right, we have to put together a budget for next year. And we're forecasting that income taxes are down and sales tax are down. Revenue is down in some places by up to 25%. And so what exactly are they going to do in order to keep, paying all of their firefighters and hospitals? What has to happen here is fairly simple, I think. We can't afford to have another recovery slowed down by huge cuts across states and local governments the same way we had in 2010 after the Great Recession. The federal government needs to step up, and it needs to bail out a lot of states right now. It needs to spend tens of billions of dollars in order to make sure that we don't have a recovery in 2020 and 2021, essentially hampered by the fact that state and local governments are still in a recession in that time. The question is great. It's a huge concern. And the solution here is federal money.
All right, back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Cheryl. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, love your show.
Thank you.
I have two questions. What differentiates your forest fire hypothesis after COVID from white flight from cities? And where do poor people who are disproportionately people of color fit into your analysis?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's been truly illuminated by the crisis is that this is not a great equalizer. This has had very unequal effects on the rich and poor and on white populations, minority populations. Some of this is the result of pre-existing health disparities in the U.S. population. Some of it is the result of the fact that the privilege of working from home is a kind of social vaccination. I am much less likely to get COVID working from my bedroom where I'm talking to you right now than I am working at a meatpacking plant or in a grocery store or on an assembly line for a car. And so I think it's really, important to be clear that what we're looking at right now is not, an equal country that's equally affected by and threatened by this crisis, but rather a very unequal country whose inequalities have been illuminated and in many cases exaggerated or exacerbated, I should say, by the pandemic. So I think it's something to pay a lot of attention to. And I do hope that as governors are starting to open up their retail stores and their restaurants and their hair salons, that they pay a lot of attention to protecting those workers and thinking of those workers as essential frontline workers, just as essential in terms of their right to live and go to work with the expectation of coming home healthy as the people who work in our hospitals.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you think it's possible, Derek, that if cities get cheaper to live in, we could see a reversal of gentrification trends that have pushed out longtime residents, often residents of color and lower income folks who have been in cities for a long time, but find themselves priced out of the market by the arrival of people who want to, air quotes here, fix up their neighborhoods?
Yeah, I think I understand the question. Maybe you could rephrase it. Are you saying just like what happens to?
Saying cities could get more affordable, because perhaps for a time they are less desirable for a variety of reasons. They have fewer of those sort of exciting businesses. There's been a trend in a lot of big American cities where really great neighborhoods are no longer affordable to the people who have lived in them for generations.
Yeah, I think that one thing that you've clearly seen happening in the last decade is that cities have become unbelievably popular for higher income people. And a lot of higher income people have moved into cities, and not being able to afford, you know, maybe the most tony neighborhood, have moved into up and coming neighborhoods, which has necessarily, you know, raised prices for people who have lived there for several decades, and in some cases priced them out. And that sort of gentrification, you know, is a part of rising wealth across the country. And it sometimes can come with some beneficial side effects for the people who can remain to live in the, who can remain in those cities. But, you know, it comes with a lot of pain as well. So certainly one silver lining of the cost of cities coming down, and of some of the crises that cities, I think, could face in the next year or so, one of the silver linings is that, yeah, you could see rents come down. You could see, you know, housing values or housing costs come down a little bit. And that would allow, you know, middle-income people to move back into parts of cities that they had been previously priced out of. I do think that that is a possibility.
Sketch out the recovery for us. And how dependent is it on actually having a vaccine or an effective, reliable treatment for people who get sick?
So there are so many paths to potentially describe here. But let me describe sort of two paths. One path is like basically utopia, right? There's like a deus ex machina or a medical deus ex machina. A vaccine becomes available late this summer, early fall, that's immediately rolled out to healthcare workers and other, you know, so-called essential workers. And you begin to see a rather fast normalization of economic behavior as soon as in, you know, 4 or 5 months. That could happen, I suppose. But what seems more likely is a bit a longer muddle through. And in order to sort of parse out exactly what that muddle through is going to look like, I've looked at South Korea. South Korea in the middle of March, or in early March, had the worst outbreak of COVID outside of China in the world. Within 60 days, they reduced new daily cases from about 900 to about 9. So just an extraordinary battle was waged against the virus, and the Korean population basically won. You know, they deal with outbreaks here and there, but they basically won. What they're doing is they're sort of very slowly and very carefully reopening the economy, entrusting in their population the responsibility to be really careful about who they interact with and how they behave. Mask wearing is nearly universal in Seoul, the capital of Korea. And restaurants are opening slowly, but not everyone is rushing back. And baseball has come back, but right now the stadiums are empty, and they're going to be reopened to sort of 20%, and then maybe 30%, maybe 40%, depending on how it goes. And they're doing a very, very careful reopening of the economy. And I think that's what we should emulate. It's going to take a long time to get back to normal, but we have to do this carefully, or else it's going to be a stop-start recovery that gets us nowhere.
Derek Thompson writes about economics, technology, and the media for The Atlantic. His article, "The Pandemic Will Change American Retail Forever," is available online. Derek, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us today.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook, and you can listen to us via podcast using any podcast app you like. Just search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.